Finally to Scotland. There will be a weather warning for the strength of the wind across the far north. The winds could touch storm force for the Northern Isles. Elsewhere, it'll be a mixture of sunny spells and showers and a high on the day of 8.
Thanks very much, Phil. Well, now on Radio 4, Penelope Wilton continues to read from Charles Dickens' A Life, the acclaimed new biography by Claire Tomlin. In today's extract, the 29-year-old Dickens is an undisputed success. Written in monthly instalments, he's now completed several novels, including The Pickwick Papers, Oliver Twist, and The Old Curiosity Shop. We join him in 1841, when arrangements have been made for his four young children to be cared for, while he and his wife Catherine set out to conquer America.
Dickens was going to America to give himself a mental shake, as well as a holiday from the pressure of constant writing. He knew he could be certain of a warm reception. Enthusiasm for his work among American readers ran high, and he was confident that he would be able to gather enough material from his travels to make a book. The Americans, for their part, saw him as the great Republican of the literary world, the English writer who was on their side, who believed in liberty and democracy, and who showed in his books that he cared about ordinary people and thought the poor more worthy of attention than the rich. They prepared to give him and his wife Catherine an ecstatic welcome. Boston, their first American city, delighted Dickens. There were no beggars, and the city was run on admirable principles, with state-funded welfare institutions. Some Bostonians had reservations about their famous visitor, finding him touched by rowdyism, their word for vulgarity, with his coloured waistcoats and long hair, but then succumbed to his charm and acknowledged how clever he was. He was able to spend a day visiting factories and was much impressed by what he saw. So far, so good. But it was not long before he and Catherine began to wilt under the requests for autographs, the cheering crowds that gathered when he went out in the afternoon, the ladies who tried to snip bits off his fur coat and asked for locks of his hair. America was gripped by hysteria. New York was preparing an extravaganza, a Boz Ball, for 3,000 people. When all the guests were assembled, Dickens appeared on the arm of a general in full dress uniform as the band played See the Conquering Hero Comes. Actors then presented a series of tableaux from the novels, after which food was served. Dickens sent his friend Maclise the bill of fare, which included 50,000 oysters, 10,000 sandwiches, 40 hams, 50 jellied turkeys, 12 floating swans, 350 quarts of jelly. Then there was dancing. Throughout the American trip, Catherine was at her very best, not only uncomplaining, but always cheerful, charming, and a good companion to her husband. Being his only ally among strangers, with no children, friends, family, or work to distract him, clearly changed the balance between them. Still more important, the simple fact of not being pregnant allowed her to be herself and to enjoy herself. In Washington, Dickens was not impressed by what he heard at the Senate and the House of Representatives, but he sent a polite account to his Boston friend Charles Sumner, describing Senator Henry Clay as a fine fellow who has won my heart. He went on, "I have seen no place yet that I like so well as Boston. We are now in the regions of slavery, spittoons, and senators. All three are evils in all countries." Going into slave-owning states so upset him by its blatant inhumanity that he decided to turn back after a short stay. After Washington and Virginia, they proceeded to St. Louis along the Mississippi, the beastliest river in the world. In mid-April, Dickens made a dash into the prairie before they turned north again, hiring a private coach to take them from Cincinnati to Lake Erie. The only road was a corduroy road, made of logs so rough that to the four of them inside the coach it felt like going up a steep flight of stairs in an omnibus. The scale of the journey they were making is astonishing, and their resilience admirable as they went on through wild terrain. Dickens was moved by the plight of the native people, known to him as the Wyandot Indians. They reminded him of home, because they looked like the gypsies he had often seen at English racecourses. By the end of June, the whole family was back in London. They had acquired a new member, 15-year-old Georgina, Catherine's sister, blue-eyed, pretty, bright. She idolised her brother-in-law, while he was delighted to have two pairs of petticoats to go about with, and made her his pet. At the end of the year, Dickens returned to fiction and embarked on a new serial novel, Martin Chuzzlewit. The return to fiction was a dismaying experience. The first monthly number of Chuzzlewit appeared in December 1843, and it was soon clear that the public did not warm to it. He began to think of going away, but then an idea came to him for a short book to be sold at Christmas. He told his Boston friend Felton that he had composed it in his head, weeping and laughing and weeping again as he walked about the black streets of London, 15 and 20 miles, many a night when all the sober folks had gone to bed. A Christmas Carol was Dickens' response to the conditions of the working class in London. It was published on the 19th of December and sold 6,000 copies in the few days before Christmas. It went on selling into the spring of 1844, with 7 editions by May. He'd put into it his memories of Camden Town and the walk or run to work that Bob Cratchit does, and his sister Fanny's crippled son, now 4, as Tiny Tim. From his own deep self, he drew the understanding that a grown man may pity the child he had been, and learn from that pity, as Scrooge does. The book went straight to the heart of the public, and has remained lodged there ever since, with its mixture of horror, despair, hope and warmth, its message, a Christian message, that even the worst of sinners may repent and become a good man, and its insistence that good cheer, food and drink shared, gifts and even dancing are not merely frivolous pleasures, but basic expressions of love and mutual support among all human beings. Dickens had been observing the women of the streets since he was a boy. He was compassionate, but not simple-minded, and he could be strictly realistic about prostitutes and men's experience of them and need for them. There were many private initiatives to help these women, but none was as bold, as original, and as imaginative as Dickens's home, which was funded by Miss Coutts, who had inherited one of the largest fortunes in England and owned Coutts Bank. His aim was to rescue two categories of young women, those who were already known to be prostitutes, and those likely to drift into it because they lacked family support, had fallen into bad company, or could get no work. They were to be offered places in the home with good food, an orderly life, training in reading, writing, sewing, and prepared to emigrate to new lives in the colonies. Each young woman was advised there would be nothing punitive or penitential in her treatment. Dickens hoped they would find husbands, which is indeed what happened to many of them. He also insisted that they should have dresses in cheerful colours they would enjoy wearing. A Mr. Dovey came to talk to them about emigration, what to expect, and what problems they might face. The first 3 inmates left for Australia in January 1849, and 27 more crossed the seas over the next 5 years. Dickens expected failures, and there were girls who were bored by the ordered life. One told him frankly as he was leaving after a committee meeting that she wished she were going out too, preferably to the races. Another took up secretly with the local policeman. One he described, after expelling her, as capable of corrupting a nunnery in a fortnight. but the majority did well. He knew he was only touching a huge social problem which had its roots in society's neglect of the housing and education of the poor, but that did not deter him. He gave an extraordinary amount of time and energy into making a success of it, seeing it as a model for others to follow. His warmth and his concern for detail can be found in his letters to the matron, Mrs. Mawson. When she was to fetch a new inmate, he wrote to her, "Will you send underclothing to Eliza Wilkin, now living with her father, with money for her to get a warm bath, that she may be perfectly clean and wholesome, and make an appointment to call for her. She has a gown that will do for her to come in. Bonnet and so forth you had better send her, I think. She is a rather short girl." He did what he did because he believed it was needed. If there was a providence in the fall of a sparrow, these girls were his sparrows, and he wanted to make them fly, not fall. On the 15th of January, 1849, Catherine went into labour. He'd planned to call his eighth child Oliver Goldsmith, then changed his mind and made him Henry Fielding Dickens, as he explained to Forster, as a kind of homage to the style of the novel he was about to write. But in truth, David Copperfield is great in a way that is peculiar to Dickens. Attachment and loss and the shaping of adult behaviour by early experience are its central themes. This was his first book to be narrated in the first person. For Dickens, the change to a first-person narrative was liberating and enriching. Where Oliver, Nell, and even Paul Dombey were the brilliant products of high artifice, David is a fully imagined, living child. Dickens's techniques are all his own. In the early chapters, David moves between past and present tense in telling his own story, carrying the reader with a "let me see" or "now I am." His descriptions are so finely accurate that he seems to be watching something taking place before his eyes as he writes. David is not the young Charles Dickens, although he is lent some of his experiences at the blacking factory. He transfers the callousness of his real parents to David's sadistic stepfather, Mr. Murdstone, and makes John and Elizabeth Dickens into the charming Micawbers, with whom he lodges while working at the factory. Micawber speaks with the voice of John Dickens, in torrents of elaborate speech, glorious in his incompetence and absurdity, and always well-intentioned. David Copperfield is a masterpiece, built on Dickens' ability to dig into his own experience, transform it, and give it the power of myth. As he wrote, he was conscious of how far he had surpassed any expectations he could have had of himself as a child. His books had made him a man of substance, who could live as he chose. His household was efficiently run by an adoring sister-in-law, and he could provide summers at Broadstairs for his thriving brood of eight children, governesses for his daughters, and superior schools for his sons. Charlie was to go to Eton in January 1850. He could very publicly raise money for good causes while indulging his passion for acting and directing, and discreetly and privately devote himself to his work at the home in Shepherd's Bush. In the summer, Dickens took a villa at Bond Church on the Isle of Wight, where William Makepeace Thackeray saw him arriving on the 23rd of July and noted, with a touch of envy, "I met on the pier, as I was running for dear life, the great Dickens, with his wife, his children, his Miss Hogarth, all looking abominably coarse, vulgar, and happy."
And tomorrow, Penelope will continue to read from Charles Dickens' A Life by Claire Tomlin. The abridger was Richard Hamilton, and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. This is B.